So welcome back to the PGR Matters podcast. This episode we have two very special guests who are co-authors of a recent book called Doctoral Supervision and Research Culture, published by Taylor and Francis. This is the first time we've really addressed research degree supervision on the podcast, so we're very fortunate to benefit from their insights from across the Aichi sector in the UK. Dr. Karen Clegg is a reader in doctoral education in the School for Arts and Creative Technologies at the University of York. And Dr. Jill Houston is an independent researcher and former chair of the UK Council for Graduate Education, the UKCGE. Together with Dr. Owen Gower, director of the UKCGE, they've produced an informative and timely publication that draws on many years of data about the supervisory experience. I've enjoyed reading it, and I think that many of our listeners will as well. So welcome to you both. Great to have you here, Jill and Karen. You've both worked on doctoral education and served on the UK Council for Graduate Education. One of the things we like to start with this podcast with is a bit about people's academic origin stories. So how did you both come to work in this area of higher education?
So I will kick off, Matthew. Thank you very much for having us. Jill and I go back a long way. I started my PhD at the University of Central Lancashire, for which I had a great time and owe them a lot because I got huge amounts of teaching experience while I was there as a GTA. And my PhD was focused on self and peer assessment and reflective practice and how that really can transform the way in which we learn. And there were then at the time a lot of activities that were being advertised around areas of learning and teaching. And one of them was a project being run by the University of Bristol in collaboration with other institutions looking at self and peer assessment. So I was very new, keen out of my PhD, and I applied for this role, knowing really that I didn't have tons of experience. But the upshot was I was offered the post by Jill. So Jill hired me a long, long time ago. And then I carried on supporting PGRs and early career researchers. And I spent some happy time at Bristol and at Warwick. And then I've been at York, primarily supporting PGRs. But having spent so much time working with them, it became so apparent the reliance and the importance of the supervisory relationship. And so I was able then to be poacher turned gamekeeper, if you like, and put together a bid for a very large project for which I'm now leading. That's the research supervision project. So Jill and I have known each other a long time and crossed over when we were both on the UK Council for Graduate Education also.
Oh, brilliant. Thank you, Karen, for that. It's great to know your academic trajectory, how you've gone into this, and also it's brilliant that the two of you are kind of linked over your careers, I guess, as you've gone through the last few years. I guess it's probably natural that you've also come to co-author this book with Owen Gower as well, so that you're working together professionally, writing together. Jill, that was Karen's side of the origin story. Do you want to tell us yours?
Well, mine's a bit different. It's a different route. I don't have a first degree. I did my master's degree in IT at City University, now City St George's, while I was working at Bristol in the careers service. Then I moved to the university's planning office in a role that included some statistical work on teaching and supervisory loads in all departments. Mm-hmm. What this meant for their annual income. So I was a planner for a while. At that point, I got involved in research education, which developed over time. My interest developed over time. And I became head of the university's central education support unit when doctoral degrees became my specialism. I think it's about at that time that Karen and I first started working together. And I was recruited into a part-time secondment with the Quality Assurance Agency, which in those days had a bit more muscle. And I chaired the group that developed QA's first detailed code of practice for research degrees in 2004. And then I went on to do the codes of practice for student assessment and external examining. During that period at Bristol, I contributed to some master's teaching and to the introductory programme for new academic staff, including the assessment and doctoral supervision modules. And with the graduate dean of each faculty, I delivered some targeted CPD for supervisors, which was really, really interesting and a huge learning experience. The university and QAA roles were really complementary. The former offered me credibility with the latter, nationally and internationally. And then at a late stage in my life, in 2010, I began a part-time PhD. I left the university. I was working with UK Council for Graduate Education at the time. And my PhD was about the final examination of the PhD. So a PhD on the PhD. And it felt at that point as though all my professional experience had led to it. And latterly, I was a member of their board, the council's board, for 9 years in the roles ultimately of chair and vice chair.
Thank you, Jill. Thank you. And I've got to say, really, I've really enjoyed dipping into your PhD thesis over the last few years.
Oh, no.
Because it really is like, you know, we always worry about what happens to our theses after we get through a viva. But yeah, yours is one I've been going back to time and time again, just simply because it's offered such amazing, unique insights into that kind of closed door, you know, examination experience, I think. And it's really, yeah, really valuable work.
Thank you, Matthew. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you. Well, thank you both. And really, what we're here to do today is talk about your recent book. This is one of the things I really love doing with my job, is actually going out there and looking at new texts that have come out around doctoral education and postgraduate research generally. And yours is something that I'm kind of keeping a watching brief on doctoral supervision publications at the moment. And a lot of that does tend to be in the form of journal articles. There are quite a few books out there as well. Some of them are a bit more kind of textbook or kind of guide related, a bit more about professional practice and kind of best practice. Yours has taken a slightly different angle because it's picking up on what we kind of know about doctoral supervision, both in the UK, actually, in the early parts of the book, internationally as well, because there have been some other countries that have done surveys with their supervisors. And one of the things that I wanted to ask you first was how you went about prioritising what aspects of the doctoral supervision experience to actually ask questions about, because one of the big surveys mentioned there is the UK Research Supervision Survey, the UK RSS. We had one in 2021 and most recently 2024, so last year. So who'd like to kick off?
I'm going to kick off because it was all my doing. And it kind of struck me almost as a light bulb moment that we knew extensive amounts about PGRs and about their experiences. And there are lots of surveys. And obviously, you know, in the UK, Postgraduate Research Experience Survey, PRES being the obvious one. And yet Jill and I were both working very much in the field of doctoral education. And it struck me that we knew very little about the supervisory experience. There were no surveys in the UK that looked at this at all. So it was a huge gap. And at that time, we had a colleague from Wellcome Trust who was part of the council. And I had this conversation with her, and she got straight back to me and said, how fast could you get me some data on this? And I said, I don't know. And I reached out to Jill and I reached out to Owen and I said, oh, they seem to be quite keen on this. We should do this. So really, we wanted to find out and fill the gap that about the topics that weren't covered by other surveys. And they were about generally the supervisor experience, but you know, what is it that supervision brings to their portfolio as an academic, if indeed they are academics that are, so who was taking part in supervision? What contribution were they making? How many of them are there that are involved in supervision? Was it one? Was it two? Was it more than those two? What did they bring in the way of a skill set? And what are the challenges that were focused on? And in particular, of course, with this being pandemic times and with us launching it in 2021, there was a whole section around whether supervisors felt that supervision practice had become more complicated, more complex in the last 5 years, and then how it related to their current experience during COVID. And what we were able to demonstrate was that it was becoming more complex over the last 5 years pre-pandemic. And so, the numbers involved, the diversity of candidates that they were supporting, all of these many themes that were contributing. And so there were lots of themes about how much time allocation they get, whether that was considered suitable. And we really wanted to dig down into work that Stan Taylor had begun to identify around what kind of training and professional development was available for supervisors. Was it mandatory? Was it not mandatory? What does that look like? Because compared with other countries, I'll use Australia and Scandinavia as an example, the UK really didn't have much in place. So in 21, we felt we were exposing a plethora of data and responses that hadn't hitherto been given any kind of spotlight. And so it was quite big news in 21. We've made a decision subsequently that we will repeat it every 3 years. So the 24 survey, as you say, took part last year. And compared with Australia has had a big survey since 2004. South Africa, run by Stellenbosch, have had a survey since 2011. And they pick up similar themes, particularly around time allocation and things like preferred numbers of candidates per supervisor. And there are very few. No, that's not fair. It isn't that there are very few policies in place. Where institutions have policies in place around minimum and maximum numbers of candidates, supervisors don't always know that. In fact, there was not much sense that supervisors typically knew what their institutional guidance was. And these are very committed people with some wonderful qualitative data that's coming through. So it isn't really ignorance. It's that we felt that the light was being shone on the lack of transparency around these areas.
That's fascinating. Thank you, Karen. It's great to understand the history of this, and particularly a very difficult time. I mean, for all institutions in driving something forward during a global emergency. So at that particular moment, I've got to say, I applaud you for getting through that period of time and getting something off the ground so quickly. Jill, did you have any other kind of comments or things that you wanted to feed in?
Just a couple of sentences, really. Aside from what we're talking about today, I would say that was the one of the most intensive periods of work for the council ever during the pandemic, because we produced some guidelines on the conduct of virtual vivas, as you know,
Yes,
Matthew,
yeah.
and other things. And it was a very intense and intensive period of work. But as far as the survey is concerned, I was immensely proud of the outcomes of the first survey. Really, the richness and the quality of the data, and again in 2024, it's more than proved that undertaking it was the right thing to do. And I noticed that the number of responses that were usable in 2024 is about 1,500 more than we had in 2021. So I think it's good to embed some of these practices quite regularly, not too often because of the load on supervisors, but just to keep the temperature of it as things and be able to monitor trends. So I'm really pleased we started it. And as far as I think you were going to ask us about comparability of the surveys and so on. And I think we couldn't really try and match anybody else's question set because, for a start, Doctor of Education is so individual. And we knew we would get different sorts of responses in some areas, not all, from different groups of disciplines. But also, Doctor of Education in each country is organised so in such a diverse way that we've taken, as Karen mentioned, the comparability that we can about, you know, the expected numbers of candidates being supervised. But otherwise, it's very difficult to do that.
Thank you. You're absolutely right. I mean, it was one of the kind of first things that struck me. I think it was right back in chapter two of the book where you're talking about these different surveys. So Australia, South Africa that you've mentioned, Karen, the Netherlands, UK 2021, and also I think France as well in 2021. Yeah. So, and yes, they do have very different systems. I think one of the things that perhaps might transcend some of these national idiosyncrasies, I suppose, of our higher education systems is actually one thing that really jumped out for me in the findings that you were talking about was the importance of supervisors feeling valued. And that was really, that kind of resonated with me because I've worked with supervisors for a number of years in my own institution. And I think behind a lot of questions that people have, there is a sense of how people are treated, not but by their institution and outside their institution as well through their supervisory practice. So can you elaborate on how institutions can better recognize and value the contributions of their doctoral supervisors?
I think as we saw in chapter three of the book, I'm going to set the context first, and chapter three is one of Owen's chapters. Supervisors often feel undervalued and overworked. That's on page 43 of the book. A slightly more positive picture emerged from the 2024 survey. 36% of respondents did not feel valued by their institution, compared with 40% in 2021. But that's quite a small difference, given also the increase in numbers. And a corresponding increase in those who do feel valued. So 56% in 2024 and 52% in 2021. But I think most supervisors, many especially in non-Russell Group universities, would welcome more overt signs from their institutions that their value is recognised. And I think that's summed up by this quote I'm going to give you from the 2024 report, which is, there needs to be clearer recognition of the importance of supervision in the purpose of the university to include generous time allocation and explicit distinction from one's own research goals, where those goals also need more generous time and space. And I think in many universities, the undergraduate numbers have grown so much over the last 10, 15 years, and also taught master's programmes, and taught education has sort of eclipsed doctoral education. So I think there's a real mismatch between the value that they're giving to the university. In other words, they're supporting and guiding the lifeblood of the universities, because those are the doctoral researchers are the next people who are going to take up those responsibilities. And that is not overtly recognised by universities. So I think what they can do is have time allocations for supervision and admit that actually supervision isn't something you do on top of your 100% role. Mm. It has to be factored in, especially given that it's also individual. You never have two researchers the same. You have to keep adapting your approach. And I don't think that's recognised at all by institutional management most of the time, except by those who've risen into the managerial tiers and have done supervision themselves. And that isn't always the case. I also think, just to finish, and then I'm sure Karen has lots of ideas, a huge majority of supervisors find their research supervision role the most satisfying in their portfolio. And chapters 7 and 8 of the book demonstrate they commonly go the extra mile. Mm-hmm. So even though they're put upon, they are overworked and undervalued, they really love supervision and they are highly valued by their supervisees. There's this big mismatch. Institutions don't appear to value them, except, of course, they do occasionally give recognition by promotion, etc. Yet the candidates realise, even if not right at the beginning, they realise how much the supervisor is giving them.
Thank you, Jill. That's really, really nice to sort of drill down into those areas that you've just discussed there. And I think that issue of how motivated and invested supervisors are, even though there is perhaps this mismatch in terms of recognition around that. And in some cases, in some institutions, perhaps confusion around time allocations. That's quite an interesting kind of slightly paradoxical, really. You'd sort of expect people to lose that investment if they didn't get the recognition. So there's obviously something deeply powerful about that sort of, supporting that next generation of researchers. Karen, do you want to come in there and say a little bit more about this from your, I guess, from your perspective?
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things that Jill has touched on and that I think are worth reflecting back is that part of the reason that they enjoy that relationship so much is perhaps less benevolent or altruistic as it sounds, that there is huge correlation between UKRSS and France and Stellenbosch that show that research capacity is increased by being a supervisor. Mm. They contribute to their own research, and there's all the joy, genuine joy that comes from that, of supporting the next generation who are working in their field and who, they're bouncing great creative ideas off. But essentially, if institutions or doctoral deans are listening, then there is evidence to suggest that being a supervisor and having PGRs really contributes to the productivity and the output. Mm-hmm. And so if you're having to make a case as to why you would have doctoral candidates, it's because your research capacity increases and is of a high quality. So that's worth noting, I think. In terms of recognition, if we just unpack a little bit what's meant by that, because a few people have asked, if you think about internal recognition within your own institution, then in terms of promotion criteria, then really it's quite often drilled down to what can be assessed, which is metrics. So how many successful completions have you had, and were those completions through in a timely manner? Mm. Were they on time, and potentially how many did you lose, what were the attrition rates? So it's a number, it's a quantifiable number that's quite typically used in promotion. Not always, I have to say, and there are emerging some exceptions and institutions who are willing to challenge that a little bit. And I'll say something about why I think that is in a moment. But there is also quite a lot of institutions that offer awards. Typically, they are student-led. Mm-hmm. And so the nominations would be by the student. And obviously, all the kind of that lack of objectivity that brings, but and the popularity of a supervisor. So it's not scientifically objective, but nonetheless, those awards do recognise great supervisors and great supervisory practice. Mm. And there are a few exceptions. So the University of Coventry, for example, has an award for supervisory team, which is lovely, because what that does is think about the group of people that are there supporting the candidate, not just the main supervisor, and looking at delivery of excellence and effective processes that support the candidate rather than them just being popular. When we did some focus groups as part of the research supervision project, supervisors on the whole weren't that bothered about getting an award. It was nice, and it was lovely to be recognised and nominated by a candidate. But as Jill has alluded to, what they really want is time. They want a proper and fair and equitable workload allocation. But there are a number of supervisors, particularly those who are at the early stages of their career, that really value the external recognition that can be granted through things like the Research Supervision Programme at UKCGE, the recognition programme. Mm. And that requires the development of a portfolio of evidence against a number of good practice framework elements. And there are two stages to that. There's an associate route for those with less experience and a full route for those with more supervisory experience. And what we found in the UKRSS survey data and in our focus groups is that there are a large number of academics, of people out there who we've coined the phrase of hidden supervisors. Mm. And they are people who typically are contributing to what might be an unofficial supervisory team, And these people might be, they might be postdocs, they might be research associates in arts and humanities, they might be technicians, they may be career specialists or researcher developers. But it's that sense that actually the doctoral journey and experience is supported by a large number of people. And what the recognition routes, both internal in the way of awards and external in terms of recognition programs grant, is some recognition of everybody that's involved. So it casts the net a little bit wider. And as I say, for those who are at the early stages of their career, the external recognition provides a badge and an evidence that can be used to support career advancement, to demonstrate that they're committed to good supervisory practice. And I think we're at the brink of a culture change right now, mainly in the UK because of REF. I will thank personally everybody at Research England for including in the pilot metrics for people, culture and environment, this idea that infrastructure, processes and mechanisms are in place to support the training and supervision of research students and that those processes are working effectively. So institutions for the first time now are having to think about, well, what are our processes and mechanisms and are they effective and how do we support PGRs and what kind of training and professional development are we putting in place for supervisors? So it's really forced institutions to think about this and to think about the value and the time and the recognition that they're giving to supervisors. So it's a real lever for change. It's welcome as far as personally, it's as far as I'm concerned. I'm sure institutions will say no, it's creating a ton of work, but actually it's about properly recognizing this really valuable part of research culture that we've been, Jill and I have been banging on about, that supervision matters.
Thank you, Karen. I mean, it's fascinating there because I think what you're getting at is the second part of the title of your book, which is it was about doctoral supervision, but there's a second bit, which is a research culture. And we've heard a lot in the last few years across the higher education sector in the UK around this thing called research culture, and universities have been looking into how they can foster, develop that. Looking at ways to perhaps sort of benchmarking progress in those areas. There's now a lot more, as you were pointing out, more interest in the research excellence framework around the infrastructure, the kind of the wider culture for research, not just the outputs that people are thinking about and the quality of those outputs, but actually how the process is working. I've worked in research and development for over a decade, and I've often seen the great benefits that there have been since the Roberts Review back in the early 2000s, and what that led to in terms of researcher, postgraduate research development, so PhD students and other research degree programs. But what we haven't seen as much of is the other side of that, or the kind of the other half of the bridge, which is around how supervisors are supported and how they're developed, because there's that sort of interplay of the two things, is that research students very often, as you're pointing out, they value their supervisors, they value their input, they feel enriched, rewarded, and supported by a good relationship there. And likewise, the flip side of that is the supervisors also feel that they're getting a tremendous amount of reward as well as the outputs, the research outputs that come out of that. So there's that kind of interdependency of the two. And if you just focus on one, you kind of impoverish the whole system. So you have to kind of build those two in tandem. Otherwise, you'll never kind of cross the gap, really. There's always going to be that great big chasm in the middle, which people are falling into, unless you build that bridge from both sides. So I think that's really amazing work that you're doing to kind of draw attention to that. One of the things that I was also going to sort of ask you about is one of the findings in the book was around supervisors who are securing feedback from their research students. And I found that really interesting because, I've done undergraduate teaching and stuff over the years, and I've done evaluation forms with students, and I, read the comments, and I do the evaluation forms with research students as well for training. But I hadn't been thinking, when I've worked with supervisors, how much, you know, whether I should be saying to them, you know, you should ask some questions about how I, you know, how you're supervising. What do your supervisees think about the support that you provide? So how do you think supervisors can effectively incorporate feedback from their supervisees to improve their supervisory approach?
Okay, well, I think this is a really interesting one. And before they can incorporate the feedback, of course, they have to be brave enough to ask for it. And as you can see from some of my chapters, I was able to mine some of the research and recognition submissions. We obviously got permission from those people, but they're all anonymous. But I'm hoping some of them will have read the book and seen how important it is to get some feedback from your doctoral researchers, from your supervisees. However, I think there are times and places for that. I think if you're a new supervisor who's not that confident, it's not brilliant to immediately ask your supervisees what they think of your approach and your style, because without any mediation, that might be quite severe for you to hear. But I think there are some quite good examples in the book of how some of the braver supervisors have either deliberately or coincidentally sought feedback from their supervisees. And I think the ones who have benefited enormously, because they've acted upon it and they've felt so much more comfortable with subsequent supervisees as a result of processing and, as Karen was saying earlier, reflecting on that feedback. And what you have to submit for supervisor recognition is it has to be analytical and evidence-based, but it's reflective. And I was so impressed by those people who've been brave enough to put in their accounts that this is what they'd done, or they had discovered through a different means that a particular supervisee had difficulty with their approach, or they hadn't really helped them to make the most of their potential, and as a result of that they'd completely changed. Now, there are different ways. You've asked about incorporating feedback. I think the best way of incorporating it is, first of all, think about if it's a fair reflection of what you did. Maybe ask a colleague. And sometimes, we haven't yet mentioned co-supervision specifically, but sometimes feedback from supervisees can come via your co-supervisors. And in fact, in other projects that I've been involved with, you sometimes find that a supervisee will go to a co-supervisor and say, I didn't really welcome how so-and-so, you know, did this, how my main supervisor did this. Can you sort of mediate a little bit, or vice versa? Now, that shouldn't happen, but sometimes it does, because we're all individuals. I think to start with, though, every supervisor has had experience of being supervised. And what I found from reading the accounts for the recognition program was that they've learned in all kinds of ways from that. And that's it's a form of supervisee feedback, because it's them, you know, what did I experience? How did that help me? And some of them have amazing reports of a sort of gold star supervisors that they've had, and say that they've strived to implement similar tactics with their own supervisees. Others say, I had a very inappropriate experience for me, and therefore I try not to apply that strategy with my supervisees. So I think they've already learned from their own feedback on their own supervisors when they start, if they're aware of that. I think as they begin to build a relationship, setting each other's priorities, you know, knowing what the candidate expects and sharing with them what you expect, that is a particular form of feedback. And it's very valuable because it's right at the beginning. So it stops you going wrong. If you know somebody finds it difficult to talk or they don't like presenting, you can find some, because they're going to have to do all those things while they're doing their doctorate. Help them find a way of improving those things. So just to end, direct feedback, which I have talked about a little bit, sought and received from supervisees, is discussed on page 69 of the book, if anybody is interested in that. And also on that page is an example of unsolicited feedback from a candidate. You know, that I think that's equally important to newer supervisors, as long as it's done in the right way. So I think the mediation is really important. I mean, we'd all say a new supervisor should have a mentor while they're developing their approach, and that would be something they might discuss with that person who'd be more experienced. Some supervisors check throughout the programme that the supervisee is happy, because of course their approach to that person is going to change. You know, as they become more and more independent, one hopes, you're becoming slightly more hands-off, but you need to check with them that they're comfortable with that at the same time. And one supervisor said that asking researchers to provide feedback helps to build a relationship in which straightforward reflection and feedback is possible. So the kind of openness that you hope will happen between the supervisor and the researcher.
Thanks, Jill. Thank you very much. I guess one of the points I might just pick up on there is around, I guess, the nature of the support. You're talking quite a bit about expectations there, and that was one of the big sort of big findings in your book. And I think right at the very end, you're talking about the kinds of recommendations for action. It's that, you know, setting of expectations between supervisors and their supervisees, also I guess between co-supervisors and their supervisees, because it's a bit of a triangular relationship in some ways. One of the things I guess that you mentioned earlier, Karen, was about the challenging moments. So you were the first UK RSS, you were talking about the 5 years, I guess, before the pandemic, and then in 2024 we've had the second survey as well. People have come through the end of the COVID-19 pandemic. There was probably during that period, I think, quite a lot of concern that both students and supervisors had. There were a lot of personal circumstances that students encountered. We saw a rise in, you know, the cancellation of things like fieldwork trips. There was an unprecedented increase in the number of sort of extension or concession requests in universities. So people's projects were delayed for various reasons. It was the same for, you know, established academics as well. So there's been this kind of dual role, I guess, for a while, around support for the personal as well as the professional, really, or the intellectual. Yeah. It's about understanding that person's well-being and how they're managing that process of a research degree. So how, from the responses you were getting, how did doctoral supervisors manage this? How were they actually kind of balancing this dual role, ensuring the well-being and the kind of success of the candidate and the project?
Oh, huge, huge question, Matthew. And I'll try and do it justice, because it's a great question. One of the things that the council have done with the UK RSS data is calibrate between 21 findings and the 24. And maybe this will partly answer your question in terms of what the challenges are. And it was really, really striking to us when we saw the results that the top challenge, if you like, for 21 was about supervisors' lack of time, this workload allocation, of which 34% said that was a top priority for them. So, you know, a third feeling that. Quite a huge jump from what was sort of fourth place in 21 to first place in 24. Was the supervisor being able to foster the candidate's confidence and focus and engagement. Now, I have absolutely no methodological substance behind suggesting that that's because of the pandemic, but it does make you wonder, doesn't it, whether the candidate's lack of confidence and lack of focus has in some way been created, or at least not at all enhanced by the pandemic, and by working more and more online, by losing some of those communities that the face-to-face communities that they might have previously enjoyed. We know from the press surveys that research culture is the one element of that survey that's quite low, whereas supervisors actually get a really good rating in press. Am I happy with my supervisor? Yes, says sort of 89% or something like that. I won't misquote, but actually it's the bit about the research culture and things like the opportunity to go to a conference and the opportunity to co-publish with my supervisor. They're the things that aren't rated quite so highly. And whether there is a correlation between that lack of opportunity to go to conferences and to meet people in person and to have opportunities to be asked challenging questions about your research and, answer that and gain the confidence that, albeit it's not a great experience at the time, but actually I think learn our craft as academics and as researchers by responding to difficult and challenging questions. And if those opportunities are not as great as they used to be, then you haven't got so many opportunities to develop your confidence and your focus. So I think partly the challenge, as you say, for supervisors is recruitment and selection. Is being equitable and fair and transparent about recruitment and selection processes, particularly, in the context of EDI and not assuming that where you did a PhD is the be all and end all, but actually asking questions about your motivation and your creativity and your passion for the subject, which hopefully breaks down some of those inequalities about access to doctoral education. But also a supervisor's ability, as Jill has said, to build a solid relationship with a candidate and to really understand, as I say, their motivations, why they want to do this. Because if they're going to drop out, or then they are experiencing, and we know that this is a problem, experiencing problems with funding and financial issues, then if they're not deeply passionate about the subject, they won't carry on. They've got to have that solid relationship with, I would argue, several people, not just one main supervisor, and for several people to take away the burden of responsibility from a sole supervisor, so that you have got someone, maybe a postdoc, who is nearer and closer to the experience than perhaps their supervisor, who can help with things like career advice and guidance, who can support them going to a conference and answering those difficult questions, and that you've got subject specialists, you've got methodological expertise, in many cases with professional and practice-based education, you've got someone from outside of HE, so from industry or business or creative industries, who can come in and talk about commercialization, can talk about, stakeholders. We have candidates at the University of York who are engaged in, theatre and film. And for them, it's the production and it's the putting on of a play that's part of the thesis. They want guidance from the Royal Shakespeare Company and Opera North in order to really think about it. So part of the challenges here can be ameliorated by a greater group of people, a team approach to supervision. But I recognise also from supervisors who say that in itself is problematic. You've got lots of different opinions that are potentially being given to the candidate. And, some STEM typically have more academics and more staff than arts and humanities. So, have we got the capacity to enable a team approach to supervision in all subjects? That's not equitable. So it's very complicated. But if you were going to offer a few quick tips, it would be around thinking long and hard and taking time over the recruitment and selection process, putting the time in at the start in order to develop a trustful relationship with the candidate, to think about the expectations, who's doing what, who's responsible for what. And many institutions have roles and responsibilities that are that are outlined, but having a conversation about those policies is useful, and to calibrate, as Jill has already said, you know, with co-supervisors and other members, and perhaps, you know, informal communities of practice for PGRs, and to really get a sense of what are they feeling and what are the challenges here. Matthew, I don't know if that fully answers your question, but it's complex.
Thank you, Karen. I think that's really valuable, because we're getting, I think, back to this idea that we may have said this before on the podcast, which is that in the same way as that, you know, that adage, you know, it takes a village to raise a child kind of thing, that there is a sort of it takes a community or research community to raise or develop a doctoral candidate or a postgraduate researcher. You know, it takes a university approach to that. And you've outlined, I think, a number of different roles that intersect with that relationship between supervisors and their students. I think the observations that you've made there around some of those challenges coming off the back of the pandemic are really interesting, because this is the first year now that I've welcomed students into the university who've had almost entirely online-based education, higher education, which was, you know, it wasn't that long ago that I was going through it myself. And then I got sort of a weird wake-up call in a seminar recently, and somebody said that to me, and I went, oh gosh, yeah, you've been at our university, but you haven't been at our university in terms of physically actually you know, being around these communities. And that's I think that's something that we would definitely do well to be mindful of going through the next year, 2 years, as people come through that generation. So yeah, great observation, thank you for that. Just sort of moving on a little bit at this point to think about the so chapter four, I think it's in section two of the book, you introduce continuing or continuous professional development, CPD, for supervisors. And I remember as I was reading the book, I was kind of digitally underlining all of those pages, because I was thinking, actually, CPD is a really interesting thing. So I think maybe we need to just be clear for the listeners what we mean by CPD and what we mean by kind of, you know, training or induction programs and things like that. I mean, could we first of all just like sort of give a bit of a definition? How you were treating that in the book?
Yeah, and forgive me, I probably am going to overlap with the book and the research supervision project, because that is focused primarily on enabling and supporting good supervision practice. And I realise good is a can of worms also. But the way that we've looked at it is to think about induction or onboarding, as it's known in some places. So for those that are new to supervision or who haven't had much experience of supervision at that institution, it's about enabling them to become aware of and cognizant of the policies and processes of a particular institution. So, you know, what does being a supervisor feel like at UEA compared with, you know, with York, for example? There's bound to be some differences. But also, more generally, what does it mean to be a supervisor and to talk through some of those areas of, you know, of good practice, about selection, not everybody's involved in that, but, you know, about building a positive relationship, about giving good feedback, about, you know, enabling professional development of the candidate, conference opportunities, etc. So it's opening up the doctoral cycle and helping a new supervisor to understand the different stages of that cycle, from, you know, from year one to year three and a half, depending if they're full time or, you know, or longer. And to understand the different types of support that they might be expected to give from the candidate throughout that doctoral cycle. So some of it is about the context, the local context, and some of it is about the wider context of what is a PhD. And as I've said, there are many different types of doctoral programme now. It might be performance, it might be practice, it might be PhD by publication, prior publication throughout the thesis. So the assessment is can be very different depending on the type of program that you're on. For many, it will be a 80 to 100,000 word, you know, thesis, a typical kind of output. But for others, it will be a product. It will be a computer coding or a play or a fashion show or a contribution to a curated exhibition. So, you've got to know what it is that you're a supervisor of in that sense, and how it's going to be assessed, and what your role in helping them through that creation and assessment process is. So there's all of that within onboarding. And then there's the continuing professional development, which from my perspective is more skill-based. So it is about learning skills such as active listening and mentoring and coaching and asking open questions, so that you do develop that open and trustful relationship, and that you can have meaningful and also challenging conversations with a candidate without them feeling that you're picking on them. And I think this is perhaps part of that wider context of research culture and the pandemic that we need to pick up on, is that are they robust and resilient enough, and do they have the social capital and experience of understanding that a robust conversation where they're being challenged isn't personal, and that it's part of the process of becoming a researcher. But many times perhaps we take that for granted, and that we don't unpack that, actually, that kind of cultural element. So in terms of CPD, the project that we're working on, we're looking at different ways of ways in which that might be offered. And we've conducted some focus groups with supervisors from the five core institutions. That's York, Nottingham, King's College London, Sheffield Hallam, and Coventry University. And overwhelmingly, what we found with those 108 respondents is that supervisors with less experience were more likely to take part in things like workshops on particular activities, and interventions that help them to understand the role and the doctoral journey, as I've described. Those with more experience expressed a real strong preference for discussion-based professional development. So sharing of practice, reflecting on practice, things like facilitated reflection, peer mentoring, we're piloting at the moment, and that's working really well, where you bring together supervisors from different subjects, and they will pick a particular aspect of supervision practice, for example, building effective relationships, and compare and contrast, well, what is it that you do? And we're finding that the more and less experienced supervisors are learning a huge amount from that and really enjoy it. What we were most surprised about was the readiness of supervisors to take part in 90-minute focus groups. And then at the end of it, when we'd sort of talked about professional development, they said, well, couldn't this has been great. Could this be professional development? Could we all just come together and you pose us lots of questions about our practice, and we reflect back on what we do? And essentially, that's what they want to do, whether you call it a community of practice or whether you call it shared practice or whatever name you want to put on it. That's actually what most supervisors value. But of course, that requires some time. It's not, as Jill said earlier, it's not that they should be fitting this in above and beyond the 100% that's already given the workload allocation. This has to be seen as important and part of that process. And I think what we've lost of the many, many changes that have happened in higher education is that opportunity to sit back and think and reflect and talk to people, and ultimately that's what people want. And things like the external recognition schemes that UKCGE and CEDA and other places can offer is that opportunity to talk with other people and reflect and gather evidence and think about, well, what is it that I do here? What is it that works and that I might want to refine and gain feedback and ask for feedback on? So in many ways, the recognition is a mechanism for enabling these kinds of conversations, and we're finding that that's working really well.
One thing that always strikes me, and it actually supports some of the things that Karen said, supervisors usually say experienced, particularly experienced or becoming experienced supervisors, say that one of the sources of advice they value most highly is consulting colleagues. And that's particularly when they've got a specific problem with somebody or a request from a candidate that they haven't come across before in their own experience. So they go and ask a colleague in their own discipline or a cognate discipline for some ideas. And I think that's really valuable. And if as supervisors were to get more of those opportunities that Karen was describing to come together and share practice, not just in their own discipline, but across disciplines, I think that would be really helpful. I think the other thing I wanted to point out is that generally CPD is not mandatory for supervisors. I think that's correct for a number of reasons we haven't got time to go into here, except initial training. And I think Karen's already emphasised the importance of induction for new supervisors. And it's interesting to note that in 2021 survey, 66% of respondents said that mandatory induction was in place for new supervisors. And that's now gone up to 70. And I think that's quite a pleasing increase, actually. Yeah, so I think everything is moving on. And what Karen's been describing as some of the emerging results from RSVP, I think is really encouraging. We just need to get institutions to promote these opportunities and give supervisors time to get together and share practice.
Thank you. Thanks, both of you. So over the last few years, it's certainly been one of the most enjoyable aspects of my role is you know, being involved in those conversations with supervisors from different subject areas and sometimes across the whole institution. So, you know, well outside my home faculty. And I think the sort of peer support that you were talking about there, Karen, I think that's really nice to hear that that's having such positive results at the moment. I'm a big advocate of kind of peer assisted learning projects and peer support. So I think that's really fantastic to hear. I'm just going to, I guess, finish off with a last question for you both, and also, you know, opportunity to just highlight anything that we've, you know, maybe missed or we haven't picked up. So this book is important. There's, as I mentioned earlier, there's lots of publications that have been emerging around postgraduate researchers. We've now seen more publications around doctoral supervision. Are there any outcomes or recommendations for action in your publication that you'd really like to highlight for listeners? So there are not, I know there is in the final chapter, there's a series of recommendations, but those might be things that you want to draw from the book, or they might be things actually that you've thought of since its publication that you would really want to highlight.
I was thinking around REF and PCE, and if institutions were wanting to think about the kind of evidence that they could use, or how do they improve their profile in this area, there's a couple of perhaps quick wins. The one is about increasing the visibility of provision of CPD for supervision. Quite a lot of respondents in UKRSS didn't know what provision there was or where it was. So, you know, that's a quick win. But actually, it's more than that. It's increasing the visibility both for prospective and current students and funders, so that if you're a prospective student and you're thinking about doing a PhD, then I think it would be very reassuring to know that your institution takes this very seriously, and that there is perhaps expected mandatory training for your supervisor and other opportunities for them to get together and reflect on their practice. We our Scandinavian partners that we've been working with typically engage in peer observation of supervision. It isn't something that's so common in the UK, but it is part of the associate recognition. And without question, supervisors that go and observe somebody else's supervision say they learn a huge amount, even from sitting in on an hour. And people have said to me, well, what about the students? You know, that's an invasion of their time and privacy. Again, I don't know a single student that didn't really like the fact that their supervisor was engaging in enhancing their supervisory practice. So there's a real win there. And funders really like to see evidence of that. So increase the visibility and as we've talked, enable conversations about supervision. It's relatively cheap and easy to do, is bring people together for conversations around key topics and let them drive it. It really is quite simple. There are many other things, but I'm going to let Jill have the last word perhaps on anything else that that we think is important.
Okay, well, I agree with all of yours to start with. We've already mentioned the greater emphasis on expectation setting for both supervisees and supervisors. I think also greater recognition of the shift in identity that occurs for anybody undertaking a doctorate. It doesn't matter what their background has been before, it's a change, a huge change, and it changes you. I don't think there's enough recognition about that. The importance of a partnership approach between the supervisor and the candidate, particularly as the candidate progresses. And for institutions, too many institutions think that research students, as they would call them, are expensive. They don't see them as the lifeblood that we mentioned already. They see them as something maybe nice to have, but they don't want to spend too much on them. Completely the wrong approach. And I think linked to that, recognition of the multifaceted role of supervisors. And finally, because I've got to say something about assessment, the criticality of investment in thesis development and finalisation for successful candidate outcomes is so important. Thank you very much, Matthew. That's been most enjoyable.
Yes, thank you, Matthew.
Thank you both. And as I said earlier on, I really enjoyed the book. Do pass on my thanks to Owen as well as your co-author for fantastic work that, you know, you've done together, and also the continuing project, the RSVP project that you're involved in, Karen, and the work of the UKCGE, because that organisation, I think, has provided a wonderful sort of meeting point for so many HE professionals over the years, and for students actually, because we have had, if I'm not very much mistaken, I believe there have been PhD students and research degree students in sessions before as well. And I think as the scholarship of postgraduate research and doctoral education is kind of developing over the years, I think it's these sorts of initiatives, the sorts of surveys that you've been exploring in the book are incredibly important for really to capture those snapshots. And as you were saying earlier, Jill, that taking the temperature, I guess, of the environment, the work environment, the professional environment that students and staff members are involved in. Thank you for your time. I know you're both super busy people, and we've been planning this for quite a few weeks now, and it's been a joy to have you both online to be involved. And I really hope as well that we can have future conversations and, you know, follow up on how these projects are going as well. So thank you, have a great rest of the week, and I do wish you all the best with the publication.
Thank you
very much, Matthew.